Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all around this great big world, welcome back to Deliberate. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and today I'm feeling pretty good. We got done. We've tried a few strategies that I mentioned in our last episode about making stories smaller and shipping stories smaller. We had two different ideas that our product owners work with, and one of them is working really, really well, which is to just have small stories in your sprint. So the one that's doing just 5-point stories, they're already, you know, halfway through their sprint backlog, and those stories are done. And everybody's happy about that. The team's happy about it. The product owner's happy about it. I'm happy about it. So it's going really well. So I hope you're experimenting and trying some new things with that. And today also, I have a wonderful guest that I'm very excited to have. He's a featured speaker, coach, and a trainer of both agile and development practices. And his name is Tim Ottinger. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, it's nice to be here. I'm really looking forward to this.
I have to say that one of the things, and we had Ryan on two episodes ago, Ryan Ripley, the host of Agile for Humans, and Tim, I was introduced to Tim through that show and his wisdom, and follow him on Twitter. And love the mindfulness and the thoughts that you have on agile and software development practices just in general. So it's really exciting to have you join us and talk about product ownership for a little bit today.
Sounds like a lot of fun. So this has been I'm an old XP guy from prior to any transitions into Scrum. So coming across different disciplines has been really interesting to see agile done with and without product owner roles.
Okay. Very good. And that's definitely one of the things we'll get into today. So a couple articles that I read that I think would be helpful for product owners out there. The first one is from Steve Johnson, who tries to explain why your organizations cannot innovate. Really good article, short, interesting read from Steve as always. The thing that he really comes down to, he's got a nice little quadrant grid, is things that are good and different are really hard to sell internally. Because they're different, because salespeople and marketing people and executives and everybody else don't know how to deal with them, they kind of resist them. So even if the teams or the product or the market could come up with something that's new or good and different, again, he categorizes that good and different from good and indifferent, or bad and different, right? So when you meet that magic quantity or magic quadrant of good and different, people don't know what to do with it in certain organizations. In other organizations, things like Apple or Amazon or some of these other tech companies or even companies that embrace innovations and things like that, you really get good and different. But for most organizations, good and different is scary, and that's why they don't like it.
I think that's fair. There are organizations that live for novelty, and it seems to be the one thing they really respect most of all. So it's kind of hard to bring in a mix of things that are that stretch across time. Brilliant ideas that started in the 20s and have extended through today. Well, that's not novel. That's not new. It can't be any good.
Right.
Or you get to the opposite case where you're talking about. And I think part of it is it's hard for people to imagine different. So the story I got from people who counsel addicts is when you find somebody who's a drug addict and you talk to them about not doing drugs, they see it as being the life they currently have, but without the relief. And when you talk to people who are career criminals about not committing crimes, they see the same poverty they have now, but without those bright spots where they've got some money. And I think that's typical. Likewise, if I told you that what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a mixture of flour and raw eggs and cocoa powder and baking soda, you know, and then like big gobs of butter and milk, and you're going to be thinking, well, flour doesn't taste good. Raw cocoa powder doesn't taste good. Let's skip those two. Raw eggs are gross. Milk is nice though. Let's just do the milk and the sugar. And it's like, well, that's fine, but you know, that's going to be the worst chocolate cake ever made. But it's just hearing the ingredients is hard for people.
It's the lens and the context of, you know, look at it in this situation, not in your current situation. That's a good idea. It's a really good article from Steve. The other one is something I struggle with, and I really connected with this article from somebody named the IT risk manager. I'm sure that's not his name, but I couldn't find his name. but he apparently went on a vacation and wrote about fairness in processes and systems. And it's a good example of things that I do where my product owner, product manager mind can't shut off when I look at optimization and problems and going, well, there's a way that we could solve that. He had the same experience when he was on vacation and looking at constraints with pool lounges at a hotel. And he went through, you know, some good examples. There's two reasons. So there's that reason that I really love the article. And then the other two are he really mentions and focuses on the theory of constraint, which I've started reading another Goldratt book because I'm just going to buy all the Goldratt books because I love the theory of constraints types thinking. And he made a Fawlty Towers reference. So anytime you can get those two of those things in there, I'm sold. But it really is a good example of, you know, why you see problems exist and how people solve them. He walks through, you know, what he did with the management, what the pool staff were doing wrong, what the constraints they had. Just a really entertaining article and a good example, again, of why sometimes we can't shut our brains off from solving problems that probably we should. Really good example there.
Sounds like a great exercise in inflicting help.
Yes. Yes. And I've used that phrase before, and I have stopped myself going, I'm trying to help. I should stop. And there actually, well, there's a great, you were at Agile 2017, this last week, right? There was a great, picture I saw, and I believe the guy's name is Dan, cause I've seen him before, but he had a great thing where he put tape over his mouth and had a sign and says, tell me your problem. I will not help. I love that.
That was an amazing bit of performance art or an experiment. We're not sure exactly which one, but, I got to debrief with him. That was a fascinating thing.
Yeah. How hard was it for me? I mean, and it's interesting, the tape over the mouth, I'm wondering, was that a commitment device for him or was it more of a, an external kind of, show to the person who was going to sit down or thinking about sitting down as, oh, he really isn't going to help me because he can't.
It was, he talked about taking away his own voice.
Mm-hmm.
Intentionally. That was an important part of the experiment. And then that symbolically shows that he's taken away his own voice.
Yeah.
And he said it's kind of amazing because he even felt like while he was there, he got co-opted by people because he wasn't speaking.
Wow. So some great articles. And again, things I really focus on, you know, when I see these things, it's just good to share. So I think Steve's came out a little while ago, but I just got through it in my pocket list because I have lots of reading stuff that I need to do.
Do you put links in your show notes?
I do, yes. We'll have links to both of those in there.
That'll be great. Thank you.
Yep. No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
So the topic today, and the reason Tim is here, is because one of the things that I've noticed lately, I started noticing probably about a month ago, is Tim on Twitter kind of talking about Scrum and not Scrum, and these things are you know, the Scrum Guide says, and blah blah blah. And then there was an episode of Agile for Humans that he and several other people were on talking about the future of Scrum, and that's a really good discussion. And I really wanted to dive in. That episode and the Twitter rants, Tim, inspired me to say, let's dig in, because I'm guessing that a majority of the people that are product owners have never read the Scrum Guide and never seen what the Scrum Guide says about the product owner role. They've seen a video, they've gone to a training class, but they haven't read the guide. So I wanted to sit down and go through the guide, and it's great to have you along to do this with, is what does the Scrum Guide actually say about product owners and why is that important?
I think this is great. There's before we do that, let's make sure that we're clear about one thing. I have been really strong about being clear in language.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say not Scrum, that doesn't mean not a good idea.
Correct.
And it doesn't mean not viable, and it doesn't mean not agile necessarily.
Right.
There are violations of the Scrum Guide which are perfectly reasonable, I think, mm-hmm. and others which are less reasonable. Some which move you to deeper agility, and some which absolutely leave agility behind.
Yeah.
So just so you know, when we say that's not Scrum, Scrum is a definition. It's a 16-page definition written by Schwaber and Sutherland, mm-hmm. and they have declared that it is the official rules of the game and that Scrum only exists in its entirety, that minus any of these pieces, it does not actually qualify as Scrum, although you may add anything you want to it. And I just want to make sure that's clear in the language. And I'm not saying that people should do pure Scrum or not do it. I'm just saying you should probably call it what it is.
Yes. And I think that's the thing I wanted to start off with is something you mentioned there is that Agile and Scrum are not the same things. Agile is a whole, is you know, beliefs, values, and, you know, it's not a process. It's values and beliefs. And Scrum is a process framework. That's how they define it, right?
Right. And of course, Agile involves other frameworks and other processes Correct. That are not Scrum. For instance, XP and Crystal and a whole bunch of others. So you could perfectly well be Agile and strictly by the book with some other process and not even resemble Scrum.
Right. And it's fair to say also, and one of the reasons we're talking about this is because Scrum is the most popular framework that is under that Agile umbrella. You know, you've seen surveys and, you know, the state of Agile surveys that come out and, you know, it's more than half of the teams that are trying to do something that they call Agile, they're using Scrum or trying to use Scrum for their process.
They are based on Scrum and claiming the brand at least.
Right. So let me go ahead and read the definition then. So Scrum is a framework within which people can address complex adaptive problems while productively and creatively delivering products at the highest possible value. That's in the first kind of paragraph for what Scrum is by the guide. So just so if you've never heard that before, now you have. And I think that's one of the key phrases there is, are you doing Scrum and what does that mean? I think from what you said and what I've read before is, you know, if you're say you're doing Scrum, then you're following the guide as it's written or as the letter of the law or this, you know, the rules say, do this, you're doing that.
Right. The interesting bit is on the end note, the last page of the Scrum guide, page 16 of 17. So I guess it's not the last page.
Mm-hmm.
It says Scrum is free and offered in this guide. Scrum's roles, artifacts, events, rules are immutable. And although implementing only parts of Scrum is possible, the result is not Scrum.
Right.
Scrum exists only in its entirety and functions well as a container for other techniques, methodologies, and practices. I think that probably the two pieces that are shocking there, the number one shocking piece is that Scrum is free. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yes.
You don't have to pay anyone.
No.
You don't have to have a certification. You don't have to pay for training. You don't need a consultant. You can do it however you like. And the other one is that it exists only in its entirety. Mm-hmm. So anything left out is not Scrum.
Right. Hashtag not Scrum to go with the no estimates. Right. And that's kind of where I wanted to start with. So I get, and this is part of this is me kind of exploring this, just open discussion and with you, but, you know, I've seen and heard people talk about, we do Scrum, but, processes, or we do Scrum bond processes, or we do Scrum like processes. And usually those things are seen as a negative, at least the Scrum, but right. Well, we do Scrum, but we don't do development testing in the same sprint. Okay, well then you're clearly not doing Scrum, or Scrum Bond, where we do Scrum and we have a WIP limit of 5 or something like that. So I think there's some instances of we do Scrum, we base what we're doing off Scrum and it's okay. And we base what we're doing off Scrum and it's not okay because we're not following the kind of the spirit of the rules for Scrum.
Right. And it's really hard to bring out the magnifying glass and say, well, you know, this is within the spirit of Scrum and this is not within the spirit of Scrum. Although I've been told by people, some of them who were certified and didn't know about the guide, mm-hmm. that all you really need to be doing Scrum is a planning meeting, a retrospective, and a daily stand-up, which I think is about as far from what the actual originators of Scrum said about Scrum as you can possibly be.
Yeah.
In fact, they said that it's got a few values. They state them up front nowadays. It right. used to not be in the front. And the theory of it, which is all about empiricism, empirical control mm-hmm. theory. I would say that you are better defined as a Scrum team if you do the transparency, inspect, and adapt cycle. And if you share the values, which are courage, focus, and openness, and respect.
Right.
No, and commitment.
Right.
Right. So those are the values. I would say that if you are Scrum at heart, those are the things you're doing and not the meetings.
Sure. Not the ceremonies that they lay out. Okay.
But that's me. Sutherland said you have to do the whole thing. So there you go.
Yes. I'm eagerly waiting the Scrum-like process that Tim Ottinger writes so I can look in the depth and get certified in it. So so let's go through the guide then. So there are 36 mentions of the product owner in the Scrum guide. And that's what we kind of want to focus on talking about today is what it actually says about the product owner. And then what do we think about that, right? Do we think that's something that we should be doing? Do you think it's something that, you know, either you or I disagree with the Scrum guide and either I don't do it in practice or I wouldn't recommend it in practice? And there's a couple of those. So in the truest sense, I've probably never done Scrum. So let me go ahead and get that out of the way by the book, right? I've done most of it. I've done, you know, maybe 80, 90% of Scrum things. But the first one that it mentions is that the product owner is responsible for maximizing the value of the product and the team. And that comes from prioritizing the backlog, looking at the work that the customer would, you know, find value in, and then finding a way to maximize that. I still use that definition for what I do is a product owner's maximize value for the customer.
I think that's an excellent one. And value is always interesting because, nowadays the phrasing is that they maximize the value of the product and the work of the development team.
Mm.
The first half of that, I think, is excellent. Yeah, by choosing, finding out what's most important, making sure we do that first so we have the best value we could possibly have for right. our iteration. I think that's all great stuff. But some people kind of read the last half of that and miss the first half of that.
Yes.
How do you maximize the work of the development team? Well, you make sure they do more work.
No.
And I think that that's well beyond
yes.
the actual role of the product owner as described in the Scrum Guide. So that's a troublesome bit of phrasing. Are yeah. you supposed to be maximizing the work or the value?
Yeah. And it's the work that the team actually does. I think that's the thing that I read into that, which is give them the things that are the most valuable to work on so that they can deliver those things and show that they're actually, you know, delivering the highest value they can.
Yeah. I think that what's intended is the value of, and then in parentheses, the product and the work of the development team.
Mm-hmm.
Close parentheses, but I'm afraid people read it as parentheses, value of the product, close parentheses, and open parentheses, work of the development team.
I see. Yeah.
I think that what's really intended is value in both cases, but it's just a problematic phrasing.
Yeah, I agree. Another reference to the product owner is that they are on the team. So several times people ask, is the product owner part of the team? Or are they not part of the team? The Scrum Guide says that they are part of the team. And that's something I definitely agree with.
Yeah, I've seen huge benefits where we've taken an entire team, including their product owner and Scrum Master. We got into a room for a week and mm-hmm. we worked together. I remember one on the third day of the whole session, the product owner said, "This has been incredible. Up until now, I just assumed that programmers know what to type and they're just withholding their effort. And now I see that they're really working hard. They're thinking about things and solving problems, the stuff the testers deal with every day."
Mm-hmm.
So I had no idea. As a remote product owner, I thought they were just being lazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It builds that shared understanding in the collaboration effort, which so many agile processes are trying to get to. Scrum kind of says you're supposed to be there for this because you are on the team.
Right. And what was also nice was somewhere in the second day, the product owner had to go to a meeting. And in the middle of that meeting, there were some decisions that the team needed to make.
Mm-hmm.
And the developers were saying, "Oh, man, I wish we had our PO here,"
mm-hmm.
which is something no one on that team had said up until then.
That's good. That's very good. Another thing that the Scrum Guide mentions is that the product owner position is one person, not a committee. So it's not a group of product owners that form that that position or that role. It is a single person. I won't use the single wringable neck phrase because it's not in the guide. But I do agree that the product owner, and that's how I've done it, is a single person. However, there are lots of support that person needs. So I like having a leadership team that the product owner kind of gets together with Scrum Masters and dev managers and, you know, people that they need to be to make good decisions. But I do think it is one person that makes that decision, and that is the product owner.
Yeah, it's I remember the early days. People talked about this. The problem was that you could get three answers for any question.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be better to have one answer, even an iffy answer, than to have four excellent ones.
Right.
So having one person who could say, no, this is the intent. This is what we intend. Mm-hmm. This is the problem we're solving. Let's try this way is a huge accelerant for developers who are making so many decisions every day now that it's very frustrating. So the idea is, I think it's now the phrasing is that the product owner is the sole person responsible for managing the product backlog. Mm-hmm. And then there's a caveat that the product owner may do the above work or have the development team do it. However, the product owner remains accountable.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly the next thing I was going to bring up, which is the content, the availability, and the ordering. The management of that backlog, which again is something that people complain about, that's all product owners seem to do sometimes is manage the backlog, but it is their responsibility to do that. And it is their responsibility alone. Other people, and I've talked about this in other shows, other people, we want other people to contribute. We want other people to suggest. We want other people to talk with us about the backlog and look at the backlog and share ideas and say, hey, what about this? What do you think about these ideas? Or what about moving these things up and down? But it's the product owner who's responsible for that ultimately in the Scrum Guide.
You know, responsibility and accountability are interesting words all by themselves, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
So accountability in some places means scapegoating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a shame. Mm-hmm. And I would really hate to think that anyone would sign up to be a PO. It's like, hey, your job here is to be the scapegoat when this goes wrong.
Yeah, that's not in the job description that I signed up for.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to see that. And of course, you know, a certain amount of management is the same way, right?
Sure.
It's a potential scapegoat. But I think what's intended by accountability is that you are entrusted with certain decisions and you're willing to make an account of why those decisions were made and why they seemed like a good idea and what the mm-hmm. circumstances around them were and the environment.
Yeah.
So it's basically you own your decisions is accountability. You're willing to account for those. And responsibility is similar. It's like this is something that has been placed in your care. You are a steward of this thing. You will be the caretaker. Its ultimate result is, you know, you have a major part in that and you take responsibility and accountability there. And I think that's all very positive.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, when I had children, I'm cool with the idea that I have a responsibility and an accountability for and to them.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I have to give that responsibility away, and that's all fine.
That's true.
Yeah. I think so. Accountability, I think, here is intended in a very positive light. Likewise, is responsibility.
Yeah. There's an interesting part in here that says the product owner, for a success for a product owner, all must respect the decisions that they make. And that there is one backlog that the team operates from. This one kind of is interesting because very rarely do I see product owners' decisions get respected. They may be followed sometimes, but they're always questions and they're always, I wouldn't use the term 100% respectful, at least in the situations I've been in. There's always been follow-up and always been things. So that one kind of struck a chord with me going, yeah, I don't think I do that, or I don't think I've seen that yet as a product owner.
That's interesting. So respect is a funny word too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if a product owner can say no to a feature, then I think they're fulfilling their job.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody says, hey, we want this to happen. And the product owner says, you know what? That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
We're not going to put that in. That doesn't make sense for our user group. And then it's not put in. Then that is a decision made and respected. Likewise, if somebody said, hey, I want this in, and the product owner says, you know, that really doesn't make sense right now. What we need is this other thing. And then we do that other thing. I think that's respecting the decision.
Okay. Then that kind of changes how I think about that then, because respecting and I'm conflating respecting and agreeing with or liking as two different things, and they're not the same thing. So I agree with you on that point.
And I think that I could very much respect your opinion about something, but still want to challenge and ask and maybe even argue to understand it better.
Sure.
Knowledge workers aren't very good at go do this thing.
Yeah, yes.
They're much better at... Here's our mission. Let's go there and then explore in that space.
Right.
So I've actually done a whole bunch of work lately about people are upset because the developers have disagreements. And to me, that's just a good thing. That's how knowledge workers
yes.
are. Of course they do.
Yeah.
You know, because they each need to internalize what it's for and how it works. And I think that's true with every decision a PO makes. I think you've got to be ready to communicate and
sure.
and to make account of your decisions, even to your developers. I don't think it's so hierarchical that did they take it as marching orders, but right. did they take it as direction?
Yeah. Okay. Something else that it mentions is the product owner is not included in the team size, nor is the Scrum Master, which I do when I say talk about team sizes. We talk about development team members, the team members, testers, developers, you know, BAs, designers, whoever's on the team that doesn't count the product owner or Scrum Master. So I think that's fair. And they do say in the guide, I did notice that the team size that I usually go with is 7 ±2. They actually indicate between 3 and 9 is an okay number.
Team size is funny, but it's also funny because it's a bit of waffling there. It's like the PO is a member of the team, as is a Scrum Master, until we go to count heads.
Well, that's true. That is true. I guess it's
funny a little bit.
It's why do you think they do that? Is that for? I mean, I know why we want to have smaller teams so we can better communicate and work together. I wonder why they discount the product owner and Scrum Master from that. I'm not sure.
I suppose what they're trying to do is get down to the number of material contributors, which are going to be, you know, UX developer, tester, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, we don't recognize any other, you know,
that's right,
titles.
Other than developer, but right?
We know everybody has a specialty. And so, you know, the person who's working with the technology to help get the work done is a material contributor, whereas the PO is not contributing material, but direction. And the PO is not contributing material, but training, instruction, direction.
Right. As far as selection. Work goes for the sprint, the product owner and the Scrum Master are not doing work, right?
Right. The material they produce isn't physically a part of the delivery.
Right. Let's see. The Scrum Master helps ensure the product owner knows how to arrange the backlog for maximum value. I'm curious as to how the Scrum Master does that. I've worked with, you know, dozens of Scrum Masters. I don't know if, I mean, they've talked with me about how to, you know, the team impact or team kind of contribution, but I don't know if I've had one that said you should arrange the backlog like this. So I'm kind of confused on that one.
You know, I don't think that the 2-day course prepares somebody for that.
Yeah.
I think there's a considerable additional amount of work that needs to be done. So I'm pulling up the same page. You know, I think ideally what they've done is they've made their Scrum Master, you know, a general Scrum coach. You know, I think they're actually expecting a true master of Scrum.
Okay.
Who has experience and has seen it done many ways and can help bring techniques to bear.
So it's more coaching than anything else. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And how many of them you really know much beyond Moscow and maybe a couple of other dirty tricks?
Yeah.
The whole risk-based prioritization and all of that, a lot of Scrum Masters don't have that.
Yeah.
And frankly, some of them have never participated on a Scrum team, so they have a limited view of what's possible. On the other hand, there are some Scrum Masters out there who are longtime Agilists and coaches and who have a lot to bring to the table in these kinds of areas.
Of course. The product owner is negotiates scope with the team. I think that's something that's definitely valid. I've done that lots of times. So, yeah, that's part of our role is talking with the team and seeing what's possible and what isn't possible. It's not, again, it's not a here, go do this thing. It's I need help. How can we work together on this?
Yeah, I think that's probably the primary dysfunction that you'll find is quite often becomes a hierarchical role. It's the manager who has HR responsibility over the development team becomes a Scrum Master. And now it becomes a purely hierarchical, you will do this and here's how many points you will get done.
Yeah.
And it goes on your annual review, and therefore it's an order taking shop. It really stops being a team in any kind of a real sense.
Yeah.
So that's a good call, good catch.
Yeah. The product owner is the only one with the authority to cancel a sprint once it's started. I have done that twice in my 8-year career as a product owner. I've only canceled 2 sprints, and the reason I canceled them was because the goal of the sprint was either it changed in one case or it was unachievable in another one. And we discovered that pretty quickly. And so it's a very rare thing. And they mentioned in the Scrum Guide that it's a very rare thing to cancel a sprint. But the product owner in the guide is the only one who can say the sprint is canceled.
That's right. And that's an interesting point, too, because that allows you the ability to, you know, avoid applying cost or people doing useless work, right?
Right.
which is a good thing. But in a lot of organizations, you have a lot of teams in marching in lockstep. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of canceling a sprint means being on a different rhythm than the other teams. And that's terrifying. Yeah. A lot of organizations where they feel very comfortable with the common pulse. Yeah. How did you deal with that, by the way?
Well, it's one of these things where we were in both instances, we were kind of isolated. So we didn't have other teams that were dependent on those things. And in both cases also, I didn't extend the release cycle or the sprint or anything else. We just said, look, we, instead of a 2-week sprint, now we have a 1-week sprint because we can plan and execute 1 week of work. And then we'll come back with the next sprint and plan that one. So I didn't change the sprint cadence. Basically, I just stopped it where it was and we replanned for the remainder of that cadence. And then we picked up, when we went forward.
Okay. Well, that seems like a good answer.
Yeah. Let's see. A product owner typically accepts work. It says typically accepts work, and I don't know why it says typically. The only thing I can think of is if it's a technical story that somebody else has more knowledge of, then the product owner may say, okay, you know, the architect or the dev manager or somebody else or the test manager will accept this story because it's technical. That's the only thing I could think of, although I haven't actually done that myself. Usually if I'm the product owner on a team, I accept the stories.
Yeah, I think that's nice. I think that they left some wiggle room there, and I'm sure they must have had something in mind. These two guys were, you know, doing this for a long time. Right. So that for some reason they did not make that a solid rule.
Yeah.
But they did leave a little bit of space. Yeah. But yeah, I think usually all the work is accepted because again, the product owner's job primarily is to understand and explain what those backlog items are and the value they represent.
Right.
If it's not accepted by the product owner, then I'm not sure exactly who understands what that should be and who overrides it.
Yeah. Let's see. The product owner discusses the objective or goal for a sprint with the team. Yes. Start with the goal. It's interesting though. It seemed that the Scrum Guide had the team pull the backlog items and then create the goal from that. And I've usually just created the goal first, and then we pull backlog items that meet the goal, or we find items that meet the goal. So I've usually done goal first instead of backlog items first. But the discussion of the goal with the team is listed as a responsibility in the guide.
You know, I think people miss the whole sprint goal idea anyway. I think that a lot of people, the goal is 23 points.
Mm-hmm.
And the new sprint goal is 24 points.
Right.
Which that's not a goal at all. You know, it says that it's an objective set for the sprint that can be met through the implementation of product backlog.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some kind of a theme, a common sense. And I think that's really important for teams. So if this month we're working on the validity of the data, so we're doing, you know, certain stories to capture and correct data problems in the database, and we're adding new constraints, and we're adding some code to manage to prevent invalid data to be entered, new validations and things. That's a goal, right? Our goal is to tidy up our data and tighten it up. And then there's a bunch of stories that help us do that.
Right.
As opposed to, well, you know, we have 7 customers, so each one of them has one story.
Yeah.
And then we have these other two things. We'll throw those in as well. And each story has no relationship to any other story, and people have no reason to talk to each other.
Yeah,
that's disturbing. But I understand sometimes you're going to have a junk drawer sprint, right?
Sure. Yeah, and that really gets into what our friend John Keller talks about is the feature factory. Is you're just doing things and you have no idea why you're doing them, and it's just one thing after another. It just keeps coming down the line. So yeah, those are bad things. There's another reference to negotiating and trade-offs with the product owner and team for sprint backlog items. So, you know, you negotiate with the team for backlog items, estimations, and other things, and then you actually negotiate with them on the sprint backlog. So once you have your goal, then what stories are important to achieve that goal? And that's a negotiation as well.
So I've chosen to not talk about estimates much right now.
That's a fine topic because it really doesn't talk about estimates in the Scrum Guide that much.
No, it does kind of assume them, and that's part of the game.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's something that's being revised in the next release. I know there's some big revisions in store.
Oh, really? Okay.
And we'll see.
Yeah.
But yeah, the expectations of estimation and individual assignments are kind of hinted at in various places. I'm not going to go there.
No, right, and that's
but
fine.
But certainly a discussion about the negotiation, that's interesting. So let me back away from the paper just for a minute. What I see in it is the product owner understands the work and the value of the work. And there's a negotiation with the team about what we're going to do next. And the team is going to be deciding how much they can take.
Mm-hmm.
Not really which things, but how much.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there may be a negotiation about, well, this story is too big. I can't do this. Can we do this in smaller pieces, get more validation, et cetera? That's great.
Right.
But also, if you look at the definition of a Scrum Master, a lot of what the Scrum Master is doing in his service to the team and the product owner is building a communication bridge between the two.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they recognize that a product owner more has a product and business focus,
right?
Whereas the team is going to be largely testing and development and UX and database. And so they're going to have a very technical focus.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this bridge where the Scrum Master brings these two sides together and enters them into a conversation that's productive and helps manage that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the product owner's communication skills and negotiation skills are primary, sort of like a much more, I don't know, kinder, gentler prime contractor.
Yeah.
Kind of role.
Yeah. After sprint planning, the team explains to the product owner how it will accomplish the goal. That's something that I don't remember explicitly doing. But maybe we're doing it because we're reviewing the stories that are going to be in the sprint after the team goes through the planning exercise. And maybe that counts for that. But I've never had it as a report or as a status or anything like that. It's always been more of a communication or just a conversation, really, is, hey, these are the stories on the wall. These are the ones we're doing. This is how we're going to accomplish that. So I guess I've done that, but not in a formal setting, which that phrase seems to imply.
And it also says that the team should be able to explain how it intends to work as a self-organizing team to accomplish the goal and create the increment.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's some wiggle room. There's a should in there.
Yeah.
So should be able to is great. So which basically says they need to kind of understand the work they're taking on and why.
Right.
And of course, that doesn't happen in order taking feature mills. It happens in collaborative. But a lot of POs are not developers in history or testers in history and don't really want to know this, but the idea that the team should be able to explain. I think that's important.
Yep.
I think that's good.
Let's see. The product owner invites attendees to the sprint review. So it's the product owner's responsibility, according to the Scrum Guide, to get people there. To see the work that's done. I do that myself. I didn't know, again, this is one of the things that, you know, until you read the guide, until you say, I'm doing Scrum, you know, a lot of people think of that as the Scrum Master's responsibility, but it is, according to the guide, the product owner's responsibility. It's you're facilitating and you're getting that meeting set up, and it's your responsibility to make sure your stakeholders are there.
Yeah, that was the big surprise for me. The first time I read the Scrum Guide, was to find out that the sprint review is really the product owner's meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of the sprint review is to revise the backlog based on what we've learned in the last increment.
Right.
Those were two things that nobody seemed to know. Everybody thought that the point was that you come together and do a demo so that you can score your points for having completed the work.
Mm.
And of course, in a lot of organizations, Scrum Master is the person who calls the meeting and updates Jira.
Right.
Which is really not the Scrum Master role at all. That's basically, you know, that's a secretarial job, wrong with being a secretary, but that's not the role.
Right.
The idea that the sprint review belongs to the PO, that it's the feedback to the PO allows the backlog to be modified, and that the primary output, the result of the sprint review is a revised product backlog that defines the probable product backlog items for the next sprint.
Mm.
The product backlog may also be adjusted overall to meet new opportunities. So the intention is to allow you and your listeners to make changes to the backlog. Who knew?
Who knows until you actually start reading it?
And inviting key stakeholders was real interesting. I didn't see that either. A lot of people have their sprint reviews in private.
Yeah.
It's
supposed to be an open meeting. The product owner decides what's done and what's not done for the sprint. Again, that's stories. And if we've done what we're supposed to do, which is acceptance criteria and meeting with the teams and accepting that work, then it's pretty easy to decide which stories are done and which stories aren't done. They've met the criteria. They met the definition of done. Again, those two things aren't part of the Scrum Guide. That's just kind of normal practice. But the product owner decides which stories are done or which work is done and which work is not done.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I think there's an interesting anti-pattern is really not the right word, like failure pattern, mm-hmm. right? An anti-pattern would be something against patterning. So this is a failure pattern.
Okay.
That quite often we get to the end of a sprint, and that's the first time people hear that what was needed was more than what was developed.
Yeah.
Or the first time someone finds out that what was developed was less than what was needed.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's like finding out that you're a poor employee at your annual review. That seems like that's so far too late to do anything about it. But the damage is pretty much done by sprint review.
Yeah, and it's something that I think was in the earlier version of the guide. It's not in the most current version that I've seen, but I've heard it talked about where some material has said that the sprint review is where the product owner decides to accept the work of the sprint. And I don't think that's true at all. I think the product owner should be accepting stories, the work of the sprint, throughout the sprint. And the sprint review is just where you just say, hey, we were successful or we weren't because we met the goal or we got, you know, the stories done that met that goal. But you should never accept work only in the sprint review.
Oh, Corey, we made a mistake.
What's that?
So carefully reading, because, you know, we are trying to read through the Scrum Guide.
Absolutely.
It doesn't say that he decides. It says the product owner explains what items have been done and what has not been done.
Explains what's done and what's not done.
Okay. Which in that case, I assume is being explained to the assembled body, stakeholders, et cetera, which, by the way, all of my objections disappear in a puff of grammar.
A puff of grammar.
It is.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense then. I still think the product owner accepts the stories, right? And they explain why their stories are done or why their stories aren't done, or talks about which ones are done.
In the increment, at the end of the sprint, the new increment must be done, must be in usable condition, meet the Scrum team's definition, must be in usable condition regardless of whether or not the product owner decides to actually release it,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is interesting because that puts the product owner in the decision of deciding to release or not.
And releasing is, so there's, and this is where I got hung up on an episode that we talked about DevOps. And it's something I still talk about is releasing software is a business decision. Deploying software should be something the team does all the time, right? It's whether you turn that feature on or make an announcement that you're releasing this or something else, but the team should be able to deploy that code and have, you know, feature flags or something else to say, hey, these things are on now and we can quote unquote release the software.
Yeah, I really look forward to some revision of the Scrum Guide that takes continuous deployment into account.
Yes.
I think that it was just not on the radar when this was written.
Yeah. Let's see, a couple other things that are here. Prime of the backlog, with the team. I think that's, they don't have the ceremony that is sprint grooming or, story discovery or something else in there, but it's that backlog needs to be refined with the team. Again, product owners will be doing that. The product owner influenced team estimates by understanding and trade-offs. And again, we've talked about estimates a couple times in other shows, but that's how product owners deal with estimates. They talk about trade-offs. They talk about what can we do, and they engage the team in those trade-offs.
Yeah, we call that bargain hunting. Josh has a nice blog on Industrial Logic, our company blog, about bargain hunting, which is, it may be that you can get, you know, 80% of the value with 20% of the work,
right,
which is always a good idea, mm-hmm. you know, and then you can decide if you want the rest of the value and to go to do the hard work that's necessary. So sometimes great things are free or cheap, and that does change the estimate. What I worry about is sometimes the other kind of influencing the estimates. So I've seen product owners that used anchoring. Mm-hmm. Oh, this sounds like a 2-point story to me. What do you think?
Yes.
And then everybody's going to say 3 or 2, might say 5. But if they just had, how much do you think this is? They probably would have gotten, you know, an answer that people believed in. Or how long, you know, how many points is this? This is an 8-point story. That's really a lot of work. No, I don't think so. Can we get it to, you know, can we agree it's a 3 then?
Yeah.
And that's not a negotiation that's going to make you any money at all. That's going to mean that you're going to not be completed at the end of the sprint.
Yeah. The advice that I usually give for both product owners and team is never negotiate, never say a number or whatever your measurement is. Don't talk about that. Talk about, you know, what value you're trying to get. Talk about the goal for the story. Talk about what the users will be able to do once they get it. And then you talk about ways, different ways to do that. That's what you negotiate on. You never start or argue points with anybody. That's a bad, bad smell. It's a failure pattern, Tim.
Yes. Thank you. there's another interesting bit with that, though, that, you know, we come up with a story and it's like, this is going to be a five or an eight, and fives and eights are dangerous. They go double size or one fourth the size. You don't know, because they're always big because of uncertainty and risk.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often, if we could just talk about what does that really mean? You know, what do we not know? What do we need to learn first? What are the risks? Then quite often we can come up with something better by reducing the story instead of by fudging the points.
Right. Exactly. There's a couple other things in here. We've hit a little bit of them, tracking work remaining at every sprint review. Again, you know, we're trying to implement this big epic. It's got these stories. We've done these stories. These stories remain. I think that's a normal thing that we should be doing as part of planning or release planning or something else. Progress toward a goal. Again, we had this goal for this epic. We can now do this. We still have these things remaining. I think that's a good thing to share with team members, with stakeholders. Maybe the goal's changed. Maybe that's something the product owner should look at as well. Artifact transparency. This is something I'm struggling a little bit with lately, which is, it's part of the, you know, availability and sharing and making sure nothing's hidden and everything is understood. I can lead the horse to water. I can't make him drink. So I can give my stakeholders, you know, here's our scrum boards and here's our dashboards that, you know, explain some of the metrics that we're using and everything else, but I can't make them click on it to go get it. So when they ask for the same information that's on a dashboard or ask which stories are done, it's right here. that's what I struggle a little bit with, is I am transparent. It's just, they actually have to try to do some of these things themselves.
So when you're talking about the they, which they are we talking about?
Some of my stakeholders.
Okay. Yes.
So they asked for a story, or they asked for a, you know, they presented a problem. We figured out some stories and an epic to solve that problem. And we're solutioning that with the team, and we're delivering, you know, in our iterations. And that first iteration is almost done. And we say, okay, here's the stories for the first iteration. They go, what stories? Where are the stories? What do I check? It's like, okay. you've been in our grooming sessions. You've been in our sprint planning sessions. You've been in our sprint reviews.
Here's the demo. Here's the running code.
Yes.
Here's what it looks like.
Please go use it.
What the problem was, is this helpful?
Yes.
Is this going to work for you?
Yes. That's having active stakeholders. It's not just, you know, again, it's more of the traditional waterfall, is I tell you what up front, and then 6 months later I come back and it's done, right? No, I want you to look at this every couple of weeks, and I want you to tell me whether this is, you know, right or not, or give me some feedback on it every couple of days, maybe. You have to be involved in this.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing, because, you know, on one hand, it's really convenient to look at software as buying a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm going to buy a new computer, I may order it with custom options, but then it'll arrive and it's a finished thing. And in between, I'm not involved. That's really convenient for me. And when I get it, sure enough, it has the RAM, it has the disk, it has the flash drive, it has the big screen, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that's really convenient for the person doing the ordering, but it kind of assumes that the things being assembled are pretty much standard and straightforward. I have never tried to order a new Ford Taurus with a turbine engine,
mm-hmm.
because that's not something that you can just order and it'll arrive in completed form. It's not something they know how to do.
Right.
I would have to be much more involved. But on the other hand, your stakeholders are busy people with full-time jobs already. And most of them, I would guess, are working well beyond what a lot of people would consider a sustainable pace. I see a lot of stakeholders that, you know, they're taking phone calls at 6 a.m. They're making phone calls at 11 p.m. They're dealing with time zones. In between, they're rushing between meetings and people and trying to help.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard for them not to be an absentee landlord. So the idea of, you know, having them or having them a proxy that they select to come and become involved in the work is quite hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's the product owner role, is that you have many stakeholders.
Yes.
And they have many desires, and they can imagine new things to build much faster than your team could possibly build them.
Yeah. You're always behind.
And they feel the slowness of the work as disrespect sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not involved enough to see what it is, and they really can't afford to be. So I kind of wish there was a better way, but so far, Scrum's way is that we have a single product owner, because a single point of decision is important.
Yeah.
And a point of accountability. But it really is an almost superhuman effort to wrangle stories across boundaries and organizations and stakeholders and teams.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they don't suggest that a PO has six teams.
Yeah. And there is no mention of that in the Scrum Guide, right? There is no mention of a Scrum Master or a product owner has one team or six teams. But I think common wisdom or common experience says you really can't do this with more than one team. Or if it is, and in practice, I've done it with two teams, but those two teams were on the same product. They had different kind of areas, but they were very similar for me. So I didn't have to switch context of, you know, two completely separate products or two really significant different areas of the same product. So,
and I think product owner suggests a product.
Yes.
And then it's a matter of how you squint. It's not supposed to be a committee, but if I were the product owner for Microsoft Office,
yeah,
you can bet then I would have a committee of a product owner for Excel, one yeah. for Word, yeah. one for, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think that I would try to scale that by having one person cover that entire universe.
No, I think that's where we get into scaling talk and everything else, which,
right.
again, the Scrum Guide doesn't mention at all. They don't talk right. about size of teams. It's assumed, I from my reading of the Scrum Guide, that it's one team, and that team is between 3 and 9 people, excluding the product owner and Scrum Master. So, and then Tim, you had a great article that I'll put a link to in the show notes, that there is no such thing as a Scrum team, that you wrote on your blog. And one of the quotes that I pulled out from there is, either these things that together cannot be done, in which case Scrum is a sham, or else these things are not being done, in which case the organization responsible for teaching and transitioning is failing miserably. So it basically leads to the point of you're doing Scrum or you're not doing Scrum. And either it's because you can't or you don't want to.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I've come to a very strong realization in recent months. I had a great deal of frustration before I reached the realization
mm-hmm.
that when we say Scrum, there's three Scrums. There is Scrum the process, which is, or process framework, if
mm-hmm,
you like,
mm-hmm.
That is described in the Scrum Guide. And I think that that's some pretty good work. In fact, some of the things in here are brilliant.
Yeah.
I think that it's a very good piece of work. Not everything is to taste, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I did write it. Doesn't have to be. So Scrum the process is one thing. Scrum the business is another thing, right?
Yes.
And Scrum the business is about the very things that Agile is not about, right? It's about processes and tools
right.
that are being sold. It's about training and certification.
Right.
I do training. I don't do certification. And I think education's important. And otherwise, I wouldn't do it if
sure.
I felt it was. But there is, you know, for Scrum itself, there's a whole industry, a business around
right.
around the certification and the tools. That's a different Scrum. And in fact, quite often it is at odds with Scrum the process.
Mm.
And you'll find tools that insist on things that are either anti the ideas in the Scrum Guide, or allow things that are anti Scrum in their implementations and usages. And of course, that usually happens because it's a business.
Yeah.
When your customers ask for something and are willing to write a check, and your developers, you know, would like to pay their mortgages,
yeah,
you have a tendency to take those orders and do that work. You don't have to totally believe in it. What you believe in is paying your people,
yeah.
right? So there's a business consideration.
Yeah.
But then there's a third Scrum, which is Scrum the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And Scrum the brand carries a certain glow of legitimacy and conformity and safety with it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are very interested in Scrum the brand. And so they will invest in Scrum the business. but they may never, ever have any interest in Scrum the process. And of course, they're being served by Scrum the business in their desire to acquire Scrum the brand.
Yeah.
Which is why I think a lot of people don't know this process and have never read these words about the product owner job that they're doing.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the three scrums are an interesting set of sisters. They don't get along very well.
And all you really need is Scrum the framework. Right? But,
you know, Scrum the process is free.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's well described.
Yeah.
And it's actually fairly well thought out.
And it's a pretty good read, right? It's only 16 pages. Again, we kind of wanted to touch on the product journal ones, but there's a lot more in there, as Tim's kind of hinted at and mentioned. So I encourage everybody, if you are a product owner or coach or anybody, go read it if you haven't read it yet. Or it's been a while since you've read it. If you got certified in 2008 and you haven't read it for 10 years, go read it again and see. And I'm really excited that they're coming out with a new update for it. That'll be great to see what they add to it and take away from it and actually, you know, make it more updated. So that's great. Tim, one of the things that I like to do with our guests while they're on the show is play a little game called Three Questions. So are you ready for your three questions?
I am ready. Let's begin. Okay.
The first question is, what are three apps or products that you use in your personal life and tell me why you love them?
I use Cam Scanner a lot. Cam Scanner takes photos. You can do batches of photos and then it converts them to a nice PDF at the end. So personal life, yes. Even more so, like if I'm out teaching classes or doing talks.
Yeah.
And I take pictures of all my flip chart pictures and I make a PDF. That's really great for me. And it gives me something I can give out to people at open spaces and things when we talk about them. And it's a surrogate memory. So that's one of my favorite. That's an Android app. Mm-hmm. I use the Google Office tools constantly because I like to collaborate. I don't write anything alone if I can help it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a dangerous world of ideas. You need a partner. My Fitbit Blaze has been my constant companion, and it has helped me to lose weight. I was 250 pounds. Now I'm consistently weighing in at 217. Oh, wow. A little bit more activity. I sleep better. All kinds of things it's helping me with. It's a wonderful thing. Gosh, I wish I could do four. Can I have one more?
Sure.
GPS guidance changed my life.
GPS.
It made me unafraid when I'm in foreign towns and strange places to go out and eat or go visit people. I used to hide at my hotel, and that's been the greatest change of all.
That's great. Very cool. All right, question number two. What's the second most amazing thing you've seen a product owner do?
Ooh. You know, I saw, this sounds silly, but I saw a product owner who was really concerned with how they can accelerate the work of the team. And when I saw them let go of that and make decisions about content, to see how the team flowered under that additional discretionary space and how much they grew was just amazing. So sometimes, probably the second most amazing thing I've seen as a product owner is just to let go a little.
Yeah, that's hard. I've tried to do that same thing and I've struggled with that same thing. I'm still struggling with that same thing, is stop doing so much for the team. Again, go back to inflicting help, right? Let them figure it out and focus on, you know, what's the value that we want them to deliver. So yeah, that's great. And then the third question, what product ideas are you most excited about for the future?
So I'm interested in new ideas around training, and we've got a number of interesting ideas. Davenport talked about the role of technology is to bring data to the fore at the point of a decision. Right? So wouldn't it be cool if as you're working on something, suddenly it's not like Clippy, because that was never helpful, but maybe like Amazon recommends. It's like, oh, how about these ideas? Mm-hmm. Are these interesting to you right now? Have you considered this method? Or if you're programming, it's like, do you realize that this code has had like 17,000 bugs in it in the past 5 years?
Yeah.
Whatever we can do technologically that lead that mission to decision making for knowledge workers.
Okay. Very good. So thank you, Tim. Those were your three questions. Nice and easy. And if you have any feedback or any questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at DeliberateCast, or you can email at DeliberateCast@gmail.com. If you do enjoy the show, please share it with a friend. Tell them why you love it. And while you're at it, you can leave us a rating and a review. We have one question from a listener today. It's from Adel, who asks a question about spikes and how do you handle them? He says, I'm curious how you handle spike stories when building a product. I have seen product owners pushing to have as many spikes done in the first few sprints to mitigate major uncertainties about something like architecture. This seems like a more waterfall approach than agile. Any input would be appreciated. Thanks. Spikes as stories. So I'm going to try to slice that into a couple different things. And then Tim, I'm interested in your opinion on this as well. So spikes as stories. Yes. You treat them as you do any other story. You have acceptance criteria for them. You know, what are we trying to accomplish with this spike? How do we know we're done with this spike? And then let's see about how long this spike is going to take, whether that's an estimate or something else, but we do that. We show those spikes at the sprint review. We do all those things with spikes. Spikes are something the team needs to learn. So if the team doesn't know how to do something, then that's when they'll typically ask for a spike and do that. I don't think spikes are there to design the process 100% like a waterfall thing, and then you have implementation stories. I think there's several parts of stories that are figuring out things that the team technically knows how to do, logically has an idea, but maybe they don't have everything laid out in front of them. I think that's perfectly fine to have that still as a story and not as a spike.
So I think that it's always reasonable to attack risks, but I find that it's not always reasonable to attack distant future risks.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we learn has an expiration date on it. So if we're worried that 6 months from now we'll have a scaling problem, we probably should be worrying about that 4 months from now.
Mm.
Probably not right now.
Right.
A lot of people tackle the ghosts of problems yet to come with spikes. And then by the time the problem surfaces, if ever, that data is dated and it no longer really applies. And of course, you know, it's a risk anyway, right? I'm going to spend 4 days on something with three team members, and then that may never materialize.
Right.
So I would say that doing far distant spikes is a bad idea. Attack the risks that are more immediate.
Mm-hmm.
And if it comes out that later on you find that, you know, maybe your database choice is questionable and you're wondering if there's a better one choice, maybe at that point a short spike is great. Probably not pre-day one. Probably once you have code running is a better time to do those.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of spreading them out and attacking near-term risks, not far-term risks.
Okay. Very good. So I hope that helps, Adil, and hope that gets you some ideas for the team. A couple of places that people can find you, Tim. You have a blog at agileotter.blogspot.com and very active on Twitter and very good to follow, to listen to, at Tottinge. Tottinge. And again, we'll put links to those in the show notes. Anything else you want to link people to?
Yeah. So my home of my professional work is Industrial Logic, which you can find at www.industriallogic.com. Don't be panicky when you see the two L's sitting side by side. It's supposed to be that way. And there's a blog there. If you go to my personal blog, you'll find many ideas that are half-baked and three-fourths baked. And if you go to the company blog, you'll find those things that have been vetted and really worked out to a higher degree.
Mm-hmm.
So please pop over, take a look, see what you learn and what you can teach from there. And of course, I'm on LinkedIn, where I occasionally try to be helpful and or stir up controversy.
And that's great. I love that. And that's one of the things I really like about Tim and really encourage people to do that. So thank you for coming on today, Tim.
Oh, it was great. Thanks for the invitation and thanks for the great conversation.
All right. All opinions expressed here are mine and you can find more of them at @IsCoreyBryan on Twitter. And that is episode 60 delivered. Go out and own your outcome. We'll be right back.
This show is part of the Agile Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.